Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time listening to the Guelph Politicast, welcome. Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or are just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or subscribe on iTunes. Today I talk to Paul Smith, Métis writer and activist. It is Aboriginal History Month, as I've learned much to my surprise. There's not much promotion for it. But the Guelph community, as well as other communities across Canada, are marking National Aboriginal Day on Tuesday, June 21st. The issues of our First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people is the topic of this week's show, but first my usual public service announcement. Guelph Politico is crowdfunded through Patreon, where you can contribute on a per-monthly basis of any amount you feel comfortable using PayPal or your credit card. And all that money goes to maintaining a locally sourced independent media outlet in Guelph called Guelph Politico. Through your generous donations, you'll be paying to keep the Politicast on the air, as well as regular coverage of City Council and politics in and around and concerning the Royal City. For more details, click on the giant orange P on the right-hand side of the Guelph Politico page, or go to patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. And now on with the show. To borrow the classic line from Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities, it was the best of times, and it was the worst of times, which might describe the current predicament of Canada's First Nations people. On the one hand, there's never been more awareness amongst the general public of the issues they face on a daily basis, but on the other, it only ever seems like we're on the cusp of true reform and resolution. It was this time last year that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's initial report came back, and while it seems like all levels of government are finally on board to make amends, those amends aren't coming as fast as some people might like. Paul Smith says, though, that these problems took generations to create, and they just might take generations to solve. Now, I've known Paul for a couple of years now. He was a frequent contributor to the Beyond the Ballot Box show on CFRU, and Scotty Kurtz and I have sometimes relied on his expertise and point of view on Open Source's Guelph when talking about First Nations issues. In our mostly upbeat conversation here today, we talk about the first steps to reconciliation, the road to reclaiming the history and heritage of First Nations peoples, and how the road ahead looks brighter than the road behind. Long story short, even though we only ever seem to hear about the First Nations community during times of calamity and woe, there's still so much to be proud of. I caught up with Paul Smith on the traditional territory of the Attawandaron, Attawandaronk, Neutral People, or it's more commonly named, the University of Guelph. Paul Smith, thanks for talking to me today.
Good. It's good to, thanks for inviting me on. It's good. Tashi. Sanko. What a little Indigenous welcomes too.
Yes, thank you.
And we should all, I mean, a lot of the shows where you have Indigenous content, people start by doing a land acknowledgement, acknowledging the original peoples.
That's right.
Yeah. The Attawandaron in this area. And the other thing that's interesting that's coming up these days is the fact that we acknowledge that this area is part of a treaty signed by the Mississauga with the British Crown back in 1792.
Mm-hmm. So that's not acknowledged. And I've heard the other acknowledgement for the First Nations people lived here, but that this is these were treaty lands at one point?
Yeah. So there's lots of shifting around of people, too. The Attawandaron were the original peoples, but then it was occupied by the Haudenosaunee for a part of the time, and then by Anishinaabe, or the Mississauga, or one group of Anishinaabe.
Right.
And so they were the last people to occupy the lands, and they signed a treaty with the with John Graves Simcoe in 1792.
Okay. That feels like something we should know about.
Yeah. And there is a sort of big push to make people aware of the treaties that cover all of Ontario.
Yeah, that seems...
Every stitch of the 46 treaties.
It's interesting you should say that because, not to sound lazy, but that does sound like a lot of work. And it's a bit, or at least more work than, say, talking about the history of Canada, where the French come in, establish New France, and then there's the Seven Years' War. England mm-hmm. takes over, and then English Canada establishes itself in Ontario in the 1780s, and that's almost like a year when you're in grade 6, 7, learning all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, learning all the various bans all the treaties. That is sounds like we're putting another whole history course. Again, not that I'm saying it's
You can pull it up a level, too, because there's the pre-Confederation treaties with the British Crown, then there's the post-Confederation treaties with the Canadian government, and then there's the proclamation, the British proclamation, 1763, when they realized that they had to stop the U.S. from expanding, otherwise there's going to be, you know, chaos, and they acknowledged that natives owned the land, and they set up a system where only the British Crown could sign treaties with First Nations at that point, and then that precipitated the pre-Confederation treaties, and that's what we're talking about here. The 1792 was a pre-Confederation treaty with the British governor.
Right. It wasn't with the government
of Canada.
It was with the crown.
Yeah.
With the crown directly, or in their
representatives. Yeah, the governor of Upper Canada. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's what's happening, is that the history of Canada will be rewritten over the next few decades to be not start at contact, right? To go back and to rewrite that sort of contact to modern day history too, because that seems to be what's happening, right?
Yeah, even in university history, because I took history here, it was a week, or it was a year, I should say, a year Canadian history course you had to take if you were a history major. And I think the first week was pre-contact, and then the rest of it was post-contact. It's like North America started when white people got here.
Yeah, and the indigenous people disappeared after contact.
Yeah. after they, you know, helped us win War of 1812, and then it was...
Yeah, it was a convenient spot to cut them loose.
Like, yeah.
Cut us loose, yeah.
It's...
Cynically speaking.
Yeah. I wanted to start with what happened a couple of weeks ago with Kathleen Wynne making the formal apology about residential schools, which was part of the reconciliation, part of Truth and Reconciliation. And I posed this on the Open Sources show, and considering I'm not of First Nations heritage, I would put it to you instead. It's nice to hear the apologies, and I think there is a general understanding that white people feel legitimately ashamed of the treatment of First Nations peoples. But aren't we past the time of apology? I mean, speaking as a Métis person, don't you want to see more than another politician get up and say, I'm sorry, we've been kind of seeing that for 10 years?
Yeah, well, I think what Wynne did was good, though, because it wasn't just an apology. So that's when she launched her document, The Journey Together, their commitment to reconciliation with the Indigenous peoples. So they did more than that. They committed to $250 million over 3 years on a whole range of things. You know, education, social programs, healthcare, you know, infrastructure. So it wasn't a hollow apology. It was an apology plus substance, and that was the beauty of what she did. And and I think a lot of people are thinking this is a good template for other provinces to do this, right? Because, and if you reflect back on Stephen Harper's apology, that was, people think that was just something he decided to do because he's a nice fellow, right? Well, no, he's not a nice fellow, but even Rona Ambrose says that, right? But
she's been saying a lot of things. She wasn't her boss anymore. But go ahead.
But people forget that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the apology, and was part of a legal agreement between the it's a class action suit by people who suffered through the residential schools. They took the government, the churches to court.
Right.
They were guilty, and they settled out of court with a settlement. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was financed from the agreement, so financed from the benefits that the survivors would get. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't taxpayers' dollars in that sense.
Right.
And so one of the legal requirements was for the Prime Minister to apologize. So it wasn't just because they thought it was a nice thing to do. It was because they had to meet the terms of the legal agreement. So whereas Wynne's apology was, you know, she just decided to do it.
Right. I do find it difficult, though, and again, this is something we talked about on the show, that apology came a matter of weeks after it was on the front page, this crisis at a Wapiskat, all these young people trying to commit suicide. And it was funny when she made that speech, it occurred to me, I hadn't heard anything about Attawapiskat for a couple of weeks. It seemed like there was a week or two where everyone was talking about it, and then it went away again, as if the problem was solved. And these are not problems that can be solved in a week or 2 weeks. These are long-term systemic things. And even if, you know, as you say, Kathleen Wynne has put money and capital into ongoing affairs, a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, these issues will still not be solved. And that's thinking it from a journalistic point of view, that's a difficult proposition because things go by so quickly.
Yeah, well, there's the media spin cycle, and, you know, Attawapiskat gets on the top of the page or the top of mind for a few minutes and then disappears. But I hate to be a Kathleen Wynne cheerleader, but I think that she has a genuine interest in it, and she was the Aboriginal minister for quite some time herself. So she traveled, and she got to know all the Indigenous peoples in Ontario very well, and so she's taken that with her as she in her political career. So I think it's very genuine on her part. So I think this is reflective of it, and this is not the first thing they've done. So they have a new political relationship with First Nations. They have an agreement with the Métis Nation of Ontario. Lots of truth and reconciliation activities. They did a strategy on murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls earlier, you know, a few months ago, walking together, put lots of money into that. So I think Ontario's doing a reasonably good job as a jurisdiction. You know, there's lots more to do, and as you say, this is going to take generations to change, right?
Right.
But I think they're, you know, they're moving in the right direction, and their federal cousins are kind of moving in the same kind of direction. And in fact, a lot of it's the same people they're sending. The political staffers are sending from Queen's Park have gone to Ottawa and staffing up the offices there. But I think, you know, that the federal scene is, I think there's been really a sea change in terms of what's going on. I mean, I think there's a change in the political culture as well. You know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and Idle No More before that has changed the landscape. I mean, people don't think about Indigenous peoples anymore the way they did it anymore.
Right.
I think it's changed everything. You know, the media coverage is different. It's not always very well informed, but they're looking for new people to talk to, new pundits. They're bringing in Indigenous pundits like Cindy Blastock and others. They're not going to Tom Flanagan, you know, the conservative hardcore anymore, for his comments on this stuff. So I think, and Trudeau, to his credit, you know, he had an Indigenous platform, right? He had a platform with very specific commitments to both First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. He worked to understand what's needed in the agendas and what was desired, and it was remarkable that they put out specific agendas on those fronts, and now they've been following through with it. You know, it's easy to criticize, and it's, you know, but it will take generations. But, you know, as Perry Bellegarde, the AFN national chief, says, you know, this is the first step, and it's regaining ground from some of this is going back to Kelowna.
Right.
The budget commitment, they had $8.5 billion over 5 years commitment in the federal budget, and that some of that goes back right back to the Kelowna Accord that Harper scrapped, right? So
right.
Paul Martin came up with this accord that everyone agreed, the provinces, the First Nations, Métis and Inuit organizations agreed to the Kelowna Accord, and it was going to be the blueprint.
Right.
And we lost kind of 10 years with Harper, but we're kind of gone back to that, and the money commitment is part of that. So I think And I think there are huge changes that have occurred. I mean, it's an exciting time to be Indigenous in this country because there's so much change happening.
It's interesting to phrase it like that, because usually when we hear an Indigenous story, it is a negative, and it's understood because there are tremendous issues. I think about Grassy Narrows and Shoal Lake 40, Attawapiskat, Kekishechewan.
Absolutely.
But it's hard. It's of course then the ongoing issue of missing and murdered Aboriginal women too. But to put that in a positive sense, is something we don't hear about either. To say that we have all this attention, and 10 years ago, it was an entirely different landscape.
I think in the last 25 years, you've got a lot more Indigenous people have gone to universities, lots of PhDs, lots of doctors, lawyers, and they're populating the country, right? So these are very successful, educated people, you know, like Judy Wilson Raybould, who's the Attorney General now. You know, she's a good example of a very successful person. So that's the kind of, and those are the kind of people who were behind Idle No More.
Mm-hmm.
They were educated, you know, there's a lawyer, a professor, and so that kind of organization is there. And I think that that's the wave of educated Indigenous people who are making a difference.
Mm-hmm. Does that sort of thing help? That
and then there's a real renaissance in the culture too. It's the music and the writing.
Right.
Now there's a bit of a more of a market for it. So you know, you get readers like Joseph Boyden and Richard Wagamese and many other authors and Tom King. The audience for their books has gone up remarkably in the last 5 years, right? And the music, you know, Tribe Called Red has kind of been exploded onto the scene. They had timing. Mm-hmm. Their timing was perfect when they started to record. And so I think that there's a cultural renaissance going on now too. So I think it is a very hopeful time. So there's lots of, you know, negative stories. There's lots of baggage from the past, and that is sort of the sad part of what happens with coverage of Indigenous people. It becomes that sort of negative. But that's sort of the reality that. This is part of what Canada as a country has to... This is part of the unfinished business of building the country of Canada.
Right.
So, you know, Indigenous peoples were left behind. They were screwed over, you know, for centuries. And if Canada wants to enter the 21st century in a good way, then this is the work of the 21st century for Canada, really. And I think the Prime Minister and the Premier have kind of embraced that.
Right. And I think people forget sort of the preservation of culture as a very important factor in spurning further efforts towards equality. If you think about black people in the United States, they have a culture that's all their own, that they shaped, they molded the Latino population in the United States. So the fact that First Nations people are reclaiming their language and music and traditions, that plays a very helpful role in the actual meat of the issues, which is bad condition, living in bad conditions on reserves, water issues, social issues, having those sort of heroes, whether they are the Attorney General of Canada or a really great band of Aboriginal people, band as in music, not band as in a group, but that helps. It helps the frame of mind, right?
It's an inspiration, You need all these touchstones to feel inspired, right? And you write about the culture and the going back to culture. And reviving and revitalizing culture is part of the Renaissance, right? So lots of people are going back and learning their languages, whether it's Anishinaabewin or Cree or Michif in the case of the Métis. So people are relearning those, and culture is not static either, because as you the examples of African Americans and Latinos, I mean, they have vibrant cultures,
right?
You know, they're almost dominant in the entertainment business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so indigenous cultures are kind of being reinvented and reinterpreted in a 21st century kind of way. Like, I mean, I think Tribe Called Red is a really good example. You know, mm-hmm. take traditional music and resample it and remix it and add layers to it. Yeah. And, you know, it's an excellent kind of metaphor for what's going on, you know. And rap music, hip-hop is very big in indigenous communities, you know, in the Arctic, mm-hmm. in Inuit communities, and in lots of First Nations communities. That is the music of the young people, right?
They come from a similar place, not necessarily geographically, but definitely frame of mind.
Yeah, and in terms of social status and economic status, yeah. So that's what's speaking to indigenous youth mm-hmm. there.
And of course they will reconcile that and turn it into their own thing as well, which is one of the way cultures propagate.
That's right. Change, incorporate and turn everything on its head to some degree and becomes unrecognizable in some respects. And you can see that even in the art world, you know, there is an explosion in painting too. You know, it's mm-hmm. like Christy Belcour just won. She's a Métis painter from Northern Ontario, and she just won a Governor General's Award, and so she takes the traditional style of Métis bead making, bead work, so floral designs and from nature, and she paints in that way with kind of dot, again based on Métis culture. But she's reinterpreting it for the 21st century in paintings, and she's collaborated with fashion designers.
Right.
So she had a couple of pieces on the runway in, I don't know if it was Paris or New York, that were her designs made into high fashion. So that's a great example of, you know, and she's been working away for years, and now she's been discovered and getting all kinds of recognition.
Not to get, because this has been incredibly positive so far, but mm-hmm. there is still a nastiness to this. CBC, of course, famously shut down comments to any article on their website that is related to First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely a problem in problems that need solving in these areas, like, you know, grassy narrow, lead, no clean water at Shoal Lake. It just strikes me, maybe this is a good problem to have, but I can't wrap my head around people who post racist things and, like, these deep humanitarian issues that are partly created by white people, or at least by the neglect of white people. But I struggle wrapping my head around where these people come from, the more racist people come from, and how they can be reached so that we can stop having this, I don't know if it's race, class, I don't know what it is, mm-hmm. but to stop having that part of it and to really address the problem, which is people don't have clean water to drink.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know what your thoughts
are. Yeah, well, I mean, racism exists. I mean,
sure.
And we're not unique in, Canada's not unique in having racist attitudes, and it's analogous in many respects to, you know, colonialism affect African Americans through slavery, right? So
yeah.
It's the same formula of colonialism in Canada, but it affects Indigenous peoples differently, but the same kind of social patterns, you know, the mm-hmm. low income, the impoverished, and, you know, repressed, you know, and poorly educated, and to call residential schools is really a misnomer. They were more
right.
like work camps.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I think that what part of the answer to, at least for a segment of the population that are more sympathetic, I think is the education. So, and I think that's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, their work has done. It's transformed people's perceptions of why Indigenous peoples social conditions are the way they are, because mm-hmm. people would, you know, look at it and say, well, you know, come up with some racist stereotypes of why they're like that. But the education that the TRC has done has changed at least a segment of the population's mind, that opened their eyes to say, holy mackerel, you know, if you take kids away from their parents and they can't see their parents. They don't understand what parenting is. They don't develop any skill sets to get out in the economy and get a job. And you tell them they're dirt, they're savages. You know, they can't speak their language. You know, you put their self-esteem in the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, surprise. You know, they become, you know, the underclass of society, right?
Yeah.
And that's what's happened. And I think, you know, people, a certain segment again, has realized that, oh my God, this is what happened, and, you know, that's our collective responsibility. And I think that is one of the antidotes to racist feelings, I think, is that. But, you know, I mean, I think it's the othering other parts of society is sort of an unfortunate part of being human.
Mm.
And, you know, if you're more privileged, you know, that can be an instinctual reaction almost. And if you're, even if you're less privileged and don't have a lot, sometimes that's the worst combination. Like Trump supporters, for example, right? They become the most.
Yeah.
Like that. But
it's almost disappointing. Well, it's not almost. It is disappointing that the only way to deal with it is to just shut it off.
Yeah, well, see, the CBC has come up with a new approach. You have to put your full name in.
Right.
And you're accountable for your comments, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no anonymous comments anymore. You have to be who you are, and it can come back to you, right?
So. Well, one would hope, but, I mean, unfortunately, in these online communities, you can always sort of find people who...
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's the nature of online interaction, too. I mean, there's a lot of strong opinions on social media, and even amongst Indigenous people online, there's lots of unhelpful interchanges, to put it mildly, about,
right.
You know, my opinion is right and your opinion is wrong, you know.
Right.
And, there's diversity of opinion. There's radical views and more moderate views, and, you know, Canada is a colonialist nation. We have to separate completely from them. And, you know,
right.
There's all kinds of different perspectives expressed on social media. So.
And not just your opinion is wrong, but my facts are right and the facts are wrong. There's that too.
A fact is not a fact.
Yeah. Sometimes yeah. It seems that way. Of course, one of the reasons why I wanted to touch base with you and do this podcast was because National Aboriginal Day is coming up. I've had conversations with people about whether or not there should be an Aboriginal History Month, like we have Black History Month. Is so
there is.
Yeah, so
there is.
Oh, is okay.
Yeah, well, so June is National.
It's not promoted.
Aboriginal. No, it isn't. It's more recent than Black History Month, so it hasn't got the traction that it has been building over the last few years, but it still hasn't got the attraction that Black History Month has yet. So June is the month, and there's quite a few activities going on across the country, and I guess the one in particular at City Halls. So the city this is sort of the second year of the city of Guelph actually being part of the sort of consortium that's organizing this. So it's in Market Square in front of City Hall, and the Aboriginal community is organizing it. So there will be food and dancing and music and general good time for all. That's the evening of the June 21st from 6 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be a good celebration. And it was a very nice one last year, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was music and food again. They're going to more dancers this year, so it'll be even more, and some artisans will be there and buy stuff too. So I think it'll be even more interesting than last year. And that's a deliberate effort on the part of the city, the city culture department, and the mayor is certainly encouraging it as well, and council. So it's a positive development.
Mm-hmm.
And there is lots of other activity locally. There is a Truth and Reconciliation circle that started locally to kind of help people talk about the calls to action, the 94 calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and what those mean for us here in Guelph and what we can do about them. So Carol Tyler, Jan Sherman, Bruce Weaver, and another number of other people are involved in organizing those. So those are sort of periodic.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, for example, there was one, there was a blanket exercise. They have this blanket exercise that's sort of developed of a, sort of telling the history of Canada and of North America, Turtle Island, in an hour.
Oh, yeah.
With a series of blankets on the floor that rapidly get rolled up, so there's very little land left for Indigenous peoples.
Mm.
And those who survive, at least. And but it's a really good analogy. Anyway, they had one of those yesterday, and there's a local group of, I don't know if you've heard of the group Kairos. Kairos is a social justice ecumenical effort. It's an organization, a national organization. They're doing a lot of work on reconciliation. Right now, they're having these blanket exercises in almost every city in Canada mm-hmm. over the next Aboriginal History Month.
Okay.
And so we had this one at the Dublin Street Church on Sunday, and so that was that's an interesting. You know, there is a lot of interest in this, and there's activities. There's an Indigenous Learning Circle that a few people organize, and they meet on I think it's a weekly or monthly basis. So there's all kinds of different.
You're suggesting I don't.
I mean, it's a relatively small Aboriginal community in Guelph, but there's lots of people who are quite plugged in
mm-hmm.
and quite knowledgeable, and there's a lot more getting called on more to go into community meetings and talk about reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
So churches are starting to have reconciliation services. So,
right.
You know, Bruce Weaver is one of the guys who's been going into, he's an Anglican, he's done work in different denominations. And we've done, so I remember the Interior Congregation, we've done a couple of those at our congregation as well. And we're going into a United Church one this coming Sunday to do something similar too. So there's a real opening up now of people's perceptions.
Right. Yeah, that's...
I hate to turn this positive.
No, it's... That's good. Because one of the questions I did want to ask you, and it just from the sounds of it, is the answer is yes. But are you hopeful about where things are going in terms of relations between First Nations peoples and whitey?
Yeah, no, I think, as I said at the beginning, I think it is an exciting time to be Indigenous. And you know, it really does look different this time. This does look like we're getting past a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
We're turning a corner, and there seems to be a momentum. I think... the federal election was a really good example of that. And I think that's the trajectory. You know, Idle No More and then the change in government federally have changed. It's a sea change.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been a time, and now I should say also the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So that's sort of the wake-up call. And
right.
then these other activities are just sort of part of the change. But the wake-up call was pretty fundamental. And then there's all these court decisions that have lined up to tell Canadians, you know, from a rule of law point of view, you know, all these things that were done to Indigenous peoples over the years, you know, if you want rule of law, which is part of democratic tradition, then the rules are different than you thought they were.
Right.
So that's changed, too. And it's a bit of a perfect storm of, you know, the court decisions, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Idle No More, and the change in government and the commitments that the new government made. So there have been times in the past, you know, in the 80s when the Constitution was repatriated, there was a time then when Indigenous peoples looked like that something big was going to happen. You know, Charlottetown Accord might have made a huge difference, but
right.
it failed. And then after OCA, there was the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and that looked like it might make a difference, but it didn't. So people largely ignored that.
Right.
So there is room for skepticism. There was an interesting discussion. There was an event at the Bookshelf. Tom King and John Ralston Saul were part of that.
Yes.
They were kind of the main, you know, the draw for it. So they were having a little debate between them you know, John Russell Sall was the optimist. He said he was the pessimistic optimist, and Tom King said he was the optimistic pessimist. And so they were kind of debating this about whether we were at that point that we can say we're on a different road, a new road.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tend to think we're on a new road, and it's going to go someplace good. I think good for everyone. I'll just, because that's the other thing that a lot of people say is that having an indigenous underclass is not good for anybody.
Right.
And especially one that is predominantly young people. You know, they're under 24 for the most part. If you have an educated, skilled group of people moving up as they age, they can make it, they can transform. They'd be a very positive force in society, and that's, I think, proving itself to be correct from the segment that has done that. And so I think it's and that's what Perry Bellegarde says too, you know, it's an investment in the country. If you look at it just from a self-interested point of view, from national interest, it's an investment in the country's future to you know, raise up the indigenous underclass, you know, out of the state that they've been put in. Mm-hmm. So I think there's it's an exciting time.
But there's skeptical momentum.
Yeah, well, you have to be vigilant. I think it's the vigilance, right? You know, it's like, you know, Cindy Blackstock, who won her case at the Human Rights Tribunal, saying that, you know, on reserve kids get a lot less funding per capita than kids in the provincial child welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was positive at the ruling, and now she's trying to get the real thing to happen, right? And she looked at the budget and she said it's just not there, right? So the budget was a big increase over previous budgets, but, you know, there's no magic bullet. It's just continued vigilance and pressure on the political level. And also, you know, but I think it's beyond that. It's now there's a momentum in the community that's probably not been seen in, you know, ever, perhaps, right? There's mm-hmm. a momentum in the indigenous community that is probably unprecedented.
Well, that seems like a positive place to leave it on.
Okay.
Much to my chagrin. Paul Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mikuch.
And once again, that was Paul Smith. You can learn more about the City of Guelph's National Aboriginal Day activities at guelph.ca/event/aboriginal-day. As for the Guelph Politicast, that is all for this week. The host of the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com or reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. There's also a Guelph Politico Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And of course, you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And of course, my heartfelt thanks goes out to everyone who has donated and continues to donate to Guelph Politico. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly, and until then, we will see you next time.